ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
For decades, a quantum computer has been just around the corner. So, where is it?
If you'd asked me very early on, I would have been very pessimistic.
The race to build a quantum computer...
Then I got more pessimistic.
Can anyone actually do it?
And more pessimistic.
One of the biggest tech stories on Earth. I'm Jacinta Bowler. Search for Science Friction, Dead and Alive, on ABC Listen, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. I'm David Marr. The good news is that we're not all going deaf. Yes, we're using subtitles more and more, but there are reasons for this. Reasons we'll explore a little later with the Oscar-winning Australian sound editor, Andy Wright. And for no reason at all except grim curiosity, we're taking a look at a debate in the United States that no other country on earth would hold. A debate over the best way of executing criminals. Should they be poisoned, or suffocated, or shot? It's a debate that opens a strange window onto those United States. But first, to the latest from Canberra, with this week a rather upbeat Mark Kenny, columnist for the Canberra Times, director of the Australian Studies Institute at the ANU. Mark, welcome.
Good evening, David.
Mark, upbeat, why? Come on.
Well, look, it's been a pretty tough start to this century, hasn't it? It began with 9/11 and it hasn't got much better ever since. You know, the war on terror, then the GFC and various other calamities. Eventually we had a pandemic, which was kind of new for everyone. And, of course, we've seen the rise of populism. We've seen wars breaking out. So the sort of post-war order has broken out. There's a fair bit to be glum about. But I've picked up lately that there are also a few good things happening around the place, and I just wanted to sort of group them together and talk about them and perhaps see them in terms of their cumulative good side, perhaps pointing to brighter things in the future.
I don't want to be a wet blanket here, Mark. I really don't. I hate wet blanketry. But, I mean, one of the things that you gives you hope for the future is Angus Taylor doing something absolutely ordinary. Criticising One Nation. I mean, is that really cause for transformative hope? Shouldn't he be doing that all the time?
I take your point, but I think it was, I mean, it is, and it's a good point, but the very fact that we had the, you know, this supposedly big tent Liberal Party, you know, the most successful election-winning machine is Christopher Pyne used to talk about it in Australia's history, certainly held government more than any other party since the war. And we had that party just not taking the fight up to this insurgent One Nation. So we see like-minded populist movements in the US, in Europe, in the UK. And, of course, we've seen this dramatic sort of what I describe as flatulent rise of One Nation here in this country, you know, without much in the way of substance behind it. And we've seen this curious kind of reluctance from Angus Taylor and the Liberal Party to take on One Nation, perhaps because, or the general view is that that's largely been informed by a fear that they cannot offend those voters and they have to shift to the right to sort of cover off One Nation's rise. And it's all just ended up validating One Nation's positions and we've seen the result of it. So in one sense, it's just a long overdue correction from Angus Taylor to line up One Nation and start talking about its, you know, its column of smoke, absence of much substance, and its recipes for further division. At another level, it is a good development because someone needs to do it, and he's finally doing it, even if for reasons of self-interest.
I'm going to pass by without any comment whatever your suggestion that One Nation is a fart in politics and go to the more important point to ask you, you know, the Liberal Party seems, or some elements in the Liberal Party are upset and surprised that Angus Taylor put the boot into One Nation. But correct me if I'm wrong, but if the Liberal Party wants to get voters away from the Labor Party. They attack the Labor Party. Why is it that anybody would argue that the way to get voters away from One Nation is to cuddle up to One Nation? Can you explain that?
No, I can't explain it. It's been a mystery, and it's been shown in the figures to be an absolutely dud strategy, and that's been evident for some time, and yet there's been this reluctance. I mean, there's a lot of factors here. I think Sky News and the whole right-wing ecosystem that is now so influential in driving a discourse on the sort of ragged right in the conservative circles, and so we see the Liberal Party increasingly preaching to a sort of a raucous choir, if I can put it like that. And that goes some way to explaining it. But if the Liberal Party is to survive, it needs to see off the One Nation threat. It needs to actually expose it as a whole bunch of, you know, simple solutions for complex problems that aren't going to work and that ultimately will lead to further division and to, you know, loss of wealth, loss of social cohesion, a whole range of other things. There are plenty of arguments that the Liberal Party could have been making and could have been making for some time. And people like Andrew Hastie had shown no reluctance to make those arguments. But for some reason, the right of the Liberal Party is enthralled to this kind of febrile media section and has just proved reluctant to do it. My view would be that if the Liberal Party is to survive, it needs to get rid of One Nation, and that needs to be its first priority. It's facing a Labor Party with a near-record majority. Its chances of winning the next election, according to the polls, aren't great, but it needs to actually be around for the fight. And up until a week ago, it wasn't even standing up to that.
But the fascinating thing here is that it seems to me Angus Taylor's attack was very focused, very effective, and he attacked One Nation on economic grounds. He pointed out that the unfunded policies of One Nation would kind of come quite close to bankrupting the country. But not a word about immigration, not a word about race.
Yes, well, this has been an area that Angus Taylor has kind of, to put it in footy language, kind of put in the short steps for some time now. He's shown a reluctance to directly confront Pauline Hanson right from the moment she mentioned this idea at the press club of an aspiration to have Australia having a monoculture, get rid of multiculturalism and have a monoculture. And others in the Liberal Party were very clear about how they rejected that, but Angus Taylor was decidedly unclear. Of course, he had that sort of very unsuccessful press conference where he was repeatedly asked by journalists to criticise it and essentially tried not to. So it is interesting that he remains in that space, but the argument that's been put to Angus Taylor, both publicly and privately, as I understand it, has been about, you know, getting the Liberal Party back to its core strength, which is the sort of economic management stuff, the area where it has a good standing with voters, particularly conservative voters. So that's what he's been trying to do here, and he had some pretty solid arguments against One Nation's solutions.
Yeah, it was solid economic demolition job. I wonder what Angus Taylor or perhaps some of the other old hands in the Liberal Party would have thought when they saw that football stadium in Melbourne full of Indian Australians, educated, energetic, fit into Australia beautifully. Aren't they the kind of people that the Liberal Party would once have expected to vote for them?
I would have thought so. I mean, this is a classic demographic, really, that would have leanings towards an entrepreneurial, business-orientated Liberal Party, the Liberal Party of Malcolm Fraser and of leaders before him and probably a couple since. But the Liberal Party feels like it's a different party at the moment. And we saw, you know, as I say, that it's a culturally right-wing party in ways that weren't even evident before. And you might recall before the last election, Senator Nampajimba Price, who's never been one for, you know, sort of huge subtlety on some questions. And she said in an interview, I think it was with the ABC, with Patricia Karvelas, that, you know, she sort of basically implied, did more than that really, that Labor was allowing more Indians into the country because Indians tended to vote Labor more. And, of course, this was a This was saying something that I think was believed in conservative circles, but usually not spoken directly about. And here it was, and of course, didn't really fly well for her. It didn't fly well electorally. And Anthony Albanese has developed a very strong relationship with Narendra Modi, and he's you know, he's attended a big stadium event in India, and now there's been this big stadium event in Australia, and a lot of enthusiasm for Modi, and a lot of enthusiasm for the relationship between the two leaders, and therefore between this government and this huge cohort in Australia, who, as you say, are extremely well educated. They're better educated than most other any other cohort you can think of in Australia.
Yep, and vote in Labor, it would seem. But now, today, there have been these fascinating polling figures come out about what Australians think of Pauline Hanson's policies. They've actually broken it down, not just how popular is she, but how popular are her policies. And they're fascinating because there's really no substantial policy there that has anything like majority support from Australians. And there's some really wonderful news for, 40% of Australians polled disagree with the notion of reducing funding for the ABC. 40% disagree with the notion of taking Australia out of the UN. I mean, 39% disagree that it would be better for Australia to be monocultural, and there are big chunks of undecided as well. I mean, what do you take from these figures?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because this is this speech that she gave at the press club. I was sitting in the audience at the press club at the time, and I was staggered by the whole thing, by what she was saying, and imagined straight away that it was going to cause her problems. She was insulting various key cohorts, that some of whom were drifting into her column in numbers, and it seemed to me to be absurd to be saying Australian workers are lazy, that women should be, you know, make it much harder to obtain abortions, that childcare was, had too much money being put into it, that paid parental leave, maternity leave was unnecessary, or implying that. She sort of tried to walk back some of these sins.
Yes.
And, of course, she was saying that she wanted the ABC to be a subscription-only service, the SBS to be defunded. She even told, I think it was Anna Henderson, that, she's going to be out of a job, you know, with a certain callous disregard, I think, for, a sense in Australia that we would regard that sort of bullying, that kind of Trumpian bullying from the pulpit there as highly inappropriate. So I wasn't all that surprised that these figures have started to turn south for One Nation, and I'm sort of gratified that at least my judgment about that was broadly correct. What do we see in the figures? We see that only 29% of people believe that SBS should be defunded by the government. I mean, that's really just a sort of a core of conservative voters. Yes, there's a fairly large contingent in most of these numbers, as you say, of undecided, but
I wonder what those undecided figures mean. Maybe that these aren't issues that matter much to those people.
Yeah.
Most of us haven't thought much about the abortion issue for a long time, for instance. So 39% haven't got an opinion there. Most of us have maybe not thought very much about not giving foreign aid to countries that make deals with China. Again, there's a third of us haven't got an opinion there, but none of this looks like is going to bring home the bacon for Pauline.
Well, that's right. That's the point. We're essentially a fairly conservative country, as anyone can say when they've looked at our referendum performance and generally our embrace of sharp changes in direction. So I think what you can see between the supporters of the status quo and those people in a lot of these headings, those large components of in each question of undecided, is essentially people who are not moved by the issue. As you say, they haven't thought about abortion much, but they're not proposing any change to it in their mind. And they might not have answered, yes, I'd oppose any change. But essentially, I think we can take from that a good many of them, probably the vast majority of those undecideds, would not be inclined to, they're not engaged in that issue and would not be inclined to any, you know, big political battle over it, which would cause division and lead to change. So I don't think there's an appetite in in these numbers right across all these different categories, an appetite for the kind of radically different Australia that Pauline Hanson is proposing when you add up all of the, you know, quite extreme things that she said at the press club and which they've had to say since.
And there's not much support there for the radically different Australia that Angus Taylor was preaching for at the Sydney Institute last Thursday, because his speech was essentially an attack on big government. Now, we know that big government is a big issue in the United States. Very big questions about whether it's a big issue in Australia. You know, the horrors of big government. And these figures around Hanson's policies would suggest that Hanson's followers are perfectly happy with big government. 72% of people polled about her policies said that we should look more carefully at NDIS priorities so that any cuts do not affect people that really need it. Now, NDIS is, by definition, big government. 73% say poverty in Australia is a serious problem that should be a priority for governments. And now, to be clear, this is not a poll of Pauline Hanson's followers. This is a poll of Australians. And they don't look to me like they're queuing up to vote for Angus Taylor's cut government.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I thought those numbers were really interesting as well, 72% in relation to going very carefully about cuts on the NDIS, and 73% arguing that we need that, you know, that poverty in Australia is a serious problem. Now, One Nation is a party, at least, that started out claiming to represent outsiders, particularly regional outsiders, you know, who are often lower income as a cohort, probably lower education as well, and really struggling. So it was, it's not surprising at one level, but that is a very healthy, this is a big poll. This is 2,200 and so people, and you've got three quarters of them in the case of addressing poverty, saying that more needs to be done effectively. And I think that's quite fascinating. And as you say, it does conflict with the idea of small government. Of course, from the coalition's point of view, this is, you know, bread and butter stuff. This is core messaging from the business party, really. It's about efficiency in government. It's about not having government controlling your lives too much. It's about having taxes lower. I mean, that's sort of things that people think about when they think about you know, reducing the size and reach of government.
Yeah.
It's not as febrile a debate as we see in the US and places like that. But I do think there's a sort of a sense that government shouldn't be any bigger than it needs to be. But then people are quite inconsistent about it, because there'd be very few Australians who would want to see any cuts to Medicare. It's, you know, an extraordinary program. Same with the PBS. We want to talk about lower taxes, but we want to
not
keep
going to touch them.
Services.
But,
yeah.
But what about the last on that list? Absolutely fascinating. This is a poll of Australians. Net zero should be dropped, said Pauline, with a focus on fossil fuels over renewables in the future. Support for that, 39%. You know, 39%. So there is over 60% of the country is either unsure or opposed. And yet that is at the core of not only her policies, but of course, Angus Taylor's policies as well. We've got to go back to fossil fuels.
Yes, and this at a time of very significant cost of living pressure on households, when, as we've seen with the whole climate question over a number of electoral cycles going right back to Kevin Rudd, is that whenever the economy is a difficult place to be, whenever people are struggling, we see climate change action dropping down the sort of league table of preoccupations for voters. So the fact that there isn't, you know, stronger support for dropping net zero, which is the official policy, or at least net zero by 2050 is the official policy of the coalition now, something that Scott Morrison, you know, brought in and made official, and they've now walked away from it. And there doesn't appear to be strong, enthusiastic support for sticking with that approach. That said, I would just add one caveat there, and 27%. Of people saying that they are for, you know, they're opposed to that and therefore retaining net zero. That's not very strong either. So it does show that
Mark,
it's an issue that
it's the organising principle of all of the oppositions of Australia, not the Greens, of course, but of One Nation and the Coalition. We have to go back to fossil fuels, and there's no public demand for it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point. I don't think you can argue against that point looking at these numbers. So, yeah, it's a difficult message to put together. But
nevertheless, nevertheless, you're upbeat about it all. there's a new dawn coming, okay?
Well, I'm upbeat about certain things that are happening. I've looked at Hungary and I've looked at the UK and the US and some things happening here. Even the Pope, you know, standing up to Trump on AI and on other things. I think if you put all these things together, there's a sense around Trump, for example, that the lame duck period that he's entering into now, particularly after the midterms later this year, that lame duckness is actually applying internationally as well. So we haven't seen any of those, you know, countries that Trump put extreme pressure on to join in his Iran folly. We haven't seen anyone do it. They all stood back and they sort of stared down the threats. And so we saw Trump, you know, kind of glad-handing people at the recent NATO conference. And so I think there's a sense that people are prepared to, you know, they had enough of this harshness. Now, maybe I'm getting ahead of myself here, but I do think it's important to recognise these things when they happen.
Mark, thank you very much for joining us again on Late Night Live.
It's a pleasure, David.
I've been talking to Professor Mark Kenny, Director of the Australian Studies Institute at ANU and columnist for the Canberra Times. Coming up, the United States debates the best way to kill its criminals. We haven't executed a prisoner for 60 years. Every country in Europe has abolished the death penalty, except little Belarus. But 27 states in the United States still execute murderers, particularly black murderers. They can wait a long time. Tomorrow, Florida is due to pump lethal chemicals into the arm of a prisoner sentenced to death in 1981. We've heard the stories about botched lethal injections, with prisoners taking not seconds, but more than 10 minutes to die. Some states are now executing prisoners using nitrogen, a highly contested technique with legal challenges ongoing in the US Supreme Court. Deborah Denno, a criminologist at Fordham Law School, who specialises in research into death penalty methods, says nitrogen is supposed to be painless, but that is only the theory. Deborah joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Deborah, how is nitrogen supposed to work to kill?
Well, basically, nitrogen hypoxia refers to a state where the body is deprived of oxygen because nitrogen gas has displaced the oxygen. So under normal or typical circumstances, the atmosphere consists of about 78% nitrogen and 21% oxygen. This is what we're supposed to be breathing every day. This is a method that displaces the oxygen with nitrogen. And, you know, in theory, the person's supposed to die quickly and painlessly, but we've certainly not seen that happen.
But it's suffocation, isn't it? It could be any other gas pumped into the lungs.
That's right. It is suffocation. And inmates have reacted in a way that indicates they are suffocating.
Let's have a look at one of those cases, the case of the murderer Anthony Boyd.
Yes, I mean, Anthony Boyd is the last person to have been executed by nitrogen hypoxia in Alabama. He was executed in October of 2025. And what's particularly horrifying about this case is all eight nitrogen hypoxia executions in Alabama have been horrific. But Anthony Boyd's execution, the last execution, was worse than all of them. So he survived for 20 minutes suffocating. And the descriptions are, you know, are really appalling. I mean, he was deeply shuddering and taking deep breaths. He was gasping for air. He was contorting. His body was contorting. He was fighting for his life, strapped down with a mask on his face. And what's ironic is that Justice Sonia Sotomayor in the Supreme Court said, you know, this is an execution method that lasts 4 minutes. Imagine how horrible that is. But, you know, you can multiply that by five for Anthony Boyd.
Is there some sort of feeling that because nitrogen is in the air anyway, this is a sort of a natural way to execute?
I think the argument is it's a natural way to execute. They base some of their justifications on industrial accidents where people have been exposed to nitrogen and explaining that those people didn't suffer, but when in fact we actually don't know that. So, you know, there's all sorts of very weak justifications. This was a method that came about based on a handful of criminologists in Oklahoma writing a typo-ridden 15-page report in their estimate that this is the best method when they had actually no medical background. And it was so appalling. Even one of the author's names was misspelled on the cover of this so-called report.
But it proved persuasive.
You know, honestly, David, just about anything can prove persuasive to a state that's desperate to continue its executions. Alabama was in a corner. Their lethal injection executions had been abysmal. Out of six of the people who have survived a lethal injection execution, and in other words, they've attempted to execute these people for over 2 hours, three of those six people were inmates recently in Alabama. So to continue executing people, which is a goal in death penalty states, Alabama seemed to have no other choice but to adopt another method of execution, or that's how they perceived it.
How is it actually done? I mean, you mentioned a moment ago a mask over the prisoner's face.
Yes, I mean, the prisoner is in a chamber. It's typically a chamber that may include another method of execution, like the gurney for a lethal injection or something like that. But the prisoner is put in a chamber. There's a mask that's put on his face. And it's at this point where the nitrogen is pumped into the mask. There was a concern that others who were close by might also get the effects of nitrogen. In other words, that the mask could leak. But essentially, the person is strapped down. Part of the problem is you really can't see within the mask. And when the person is struggling for air, the mask gets all fogged up, sweat gets on the mask, etc. So it's visually very difficult.
So it's like a bag over the whole head.
It is like a bag, and essentially, you know, at least originally, there was a concern that the inmate could try to take off the mask, or the mask wasn't going to fit right. But the inmate is strapped down, so they can't move the mask.
So presumably the natural response of the body would be to hold the breath so as not to suck this stuff in.
That's right. And that would make sense to anyone who may have been in a position where you were exposed to something. The person is holding their breath for as long as they possibly can. And, you know, initially, Department of Corrections officials were saying, you know, the person is trying to manipulate the process. They're not doing what they're supposed to do. If they would just breathe in the nitrogen, then they would die much more quickly. But of course, as you just indicated, it's the body's natural reflex and response not to breathe in this noxious gas.
So it was the prisoner's own fault for not making his death quicker.
That's right. I mean,
that's
this is
good.
How officials get around these abysmal and terribly cruel executions.
How many states now use nitrogen?
There have only been two states that have actually used it, but five states have it down on the books
right. For
using it.
Is it true that Boyd, the prisoner we're discussing, actually asked to be killed by firing squad?
That's right. He filed a stay of his execution, requesting an execution by firing squad. And the United States Supreme Court denied that request. And this is where, in her dissent, Justice Sotomayor, along with Justices Kagan and Jackson, described execution by nitrogen hypoxia as tortious suffocation and argued that, you know, death by firing squad would be much more humane.
And firing squad is available as a method of death in the United States?
Oh, that's right. It's now available in 7 states. This is the highest number of states for which it's been available since we've been keeping records, you know, since states have been legislating their methods, and at least until 1888.
But can you trust soldiers to actually, you know, fire at the prisoner? I know if I was in the firing squad, I'd have a bit of a temptation to point my gun a bit to the left.
Yes, and we're starting to see that, actually. I think people thought initially that was a relic of history. We haven't had that many firing squad executions in what they consider to be the modern death penalty. In other words, executions after 1976. So there's been less than a handful. But, you know, historically, that happened where soldiers would purposely miss or shoot at an elbow and somebody would bleed to death. And the last time that we have documentation of that was in 1951. That said, there was a 2025 firing squad execution in the state of South Carolina where, you know, there's substantial evidence that the individuals selected to execute Mikhail Mahdi missed purposely or missed the target purposely, even though they were only within, you know, 20 feet. There was a target on the inmate's heart. This, you're shooting at a still object, right? Not a deer or something. Yes. Running. And these were supposed to be highly trained individuals.
Decent of them, but grim for the prisoner.
Absolutely. Yes.
I am talking to Deborah Denno, a professor at Fordham University School of Law, about methods of execution in the United States. Deborah, so there's nitrogen gas, there's firing squad, the electric chair still in use?
The electric chair is still in use. It's still used in a number of states where inmates can make a choice. They could choose the electric chair if they want to. The most recent cases on that are inmates choosing electrocution over lethal injection in the state of Tennessee.
And the electric chair works, is that right?
Well, not really. Oh. There's many, many problems with the electric chair. I was surprised that inmates were choosing electric chair over lethal injection, but it goes to show how problematic they thought lethal injection was. But no, we have a history of horrific botched electrocutions, and that's why I thought that was, you know, was eventually going to go by the wayside. Indeed, 2 states have found electrocution to be unconstitutional. That's Georgia and Nebraska.
Why don't they hang people in the United States? It's also not a foolproof method, but it's a traditional method of execution.
Well, it is a traditional method of execution, and historically it was the dominating method of execution. I mean, that we inherited hanging from England, and this is what we used for many, many years. I mean, it's only been very recently, within the last decade or so, that hanging hasn't been used, and that's only because the 3 states that had hanging on the books have declared the death penalty unconstitutional. That said, Florida and Tennessee have reestablished the possibility that hanging could be used in their states. Why? Because they said they would go with any method that has not been rendered unconstitutional, and hanging hasn't been.
Have we been right down the list now? Nitrogen, the electric chair, lethal injections, hanging. Is there any other method being used in the United States at the moment?
Well, firing squad, of course.
Oh, and firing squad.
Gas.
Yes.
And those are 6 six methods of execution. I don't know of any other state in the world. If one exists, then they're hiding this. I don't know of any other state in the world that's used so many execution methods and jumped from one to the other.
Until I looked at this subject again, before talking to you, I had thought that lethal injection was now out of the game because Pfizer, the last supplier of the poisons required, had decided that it would no longer supply states for the purpose of execution.
That's right. I mean, it's really the in most lethal injections in this country, there are three drugs that are used. And it was the first drug that has become so controversial, or where drug companies have said, we're not going to supply this to you. And that's because not many countries make that drug. The United States used to make it. There was one company that made it. This is sodium thiopental. But the drug is old, and not many surgeons use it anymore. And it wasn't economically viable for this one company to make it. They couldn't find the chemicals, etc. So European countries wouldn't sell it to us. So there was started to be a scramble for trying to find a sedative or replacement, a substitute, starting in about 2009, 2010. And that's what's really created many of the botches that we've seen in the last 16 years.
So what is Florida going to be using tomorrow to kill this prisoner?
Well, some states have more access to the lethal injection drugs than other states. That's number one. Number two, it's mostly a secret where states are getting their lethal injection drugs. And oftentimes it's a secret what drugs they're using. So we have evidence in a number of states that one state will go to another state and pay cash to get a particular kind of drug and do it all very secretly. We have evidence of that. We only get to see that when a case has been litigated. They may go to a compounding pharmacy. That was popular for quite a while. The compounding pharmacies will make just about anything, but they have no oversight, so they often have made problematic drugs, not for this purpose, for all sorts of purposes. So we're not really quite sure where they're getting the drug.
An early amendment to the US Constitution outlawed cruel and unusual punishment. But how cruel and how unusual does punishment have to be for the Supreme Court to rule it out?
Well, this is a very interesting question. It has to cause severe pain. That's basically the threshold. But how you measure that is very difficult, particularly since so many of these methods are, it's really hard to assess whether the inmate is experiencing pain. This has been the biggest problem with lethal injection, for example, because in most states, a paralytic is injected into the inmate. The first drug is supposed to be a sedative. The second drug is a paralytic, literally paralyzes the inmate. So they can't move in any way. The only way a sophisticated doctor, for example, somebody medically sophisticated would know they're experiencing pain is, say, if they're tearing or something like that. The third drug causes cardiac arrest. It's exceedingly painful. But if somebody is paralyzed, then they're not, we'll never know what they're experiencing.
Does any of this likely to persuade the United States to stop capital punishment?
I don't think any of this is going to stop capital punishment anytime soon. Sometimes the argument is conflated with capital punishment or whether you're pro or against the death penalty. I don't take that stance because I think this is an entirely separate issue. No matter where you stand on the death penalty, we should not be torturing people. And this is what's so appalling to me. Even pro-death penalty people should not want this kind of torture to exist.
And no one is much deterred, are they, in the United States by the fact that their traditional enemies are the greatest exponents of the death penalty, China, Iran, those sorts of countries?
we're not a country that compares ourselves to other countries, for good or for ill. So where we stand, some people may in this country, unfortunately, may be proud that we're standing with certain countries that do inflict torture. You'll see comments from people that they think torture should be inflicted. In other words, that inmates who murder should be tortured themselves.
Yes.
At the same time, I think most of the public really doesn't think about it, honestly.
Deborah, thank you very much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you, David.
I've been speaking to Deborah Denno, criminologist at Fordham Law School, a specialist in research into death penalty methods, here on Late Night Live. Coming up, why we need subtitles. I began getting worried a few years ago when I found I needed subtitles more and more. But I realised it was mostly a language problem. Murders in Birmingham, that sort of thing, you know, regional English. Needs translation, all good. But lately, I've really worried I was going deaf as I needed words at the bottom of the screen nearly all the time. But it turns out we're all doing the same. By we, I don't just mean viewers of a certain age. The young seem to be doing it most of all. According to a recent Roy Morgan poll, about 60% of Australians under 35 are turning on the subtitles whenever they watch television. There is something going on here, to explain which, Late Night Live has enlisted the help of the Australian Oscar-winning sound editor, Andy Wright. Andy joins me from Sydney. Welcome to the show.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
Now, Andy, first, the young. You have observed it, I understand, in your own family.
Yeah, absolutely. My children, who are early teenagers, young teenagers, pop the subtitles on whenever they can, and I let them know about it, that's for sure. I lay the law down, not in my house, knowing the painstaking work that myself and my wife, who is also a sound editor, go to make the dialogue clear.
But they are reading it. Are they also reading their phones as they're watching television and perhaps having a conversation through their ear pods as well?
There is a little bit of that, although I'd say more lying sideways on the couch from my experience. So I don't know how they read the subtitles in that position.
They're multi-skilled and you know that.
Yes.
But I don't have any problem when I'm watching an old movie on television. Mm. My problems come when I'm watching Netflix. Now, is that typical? Is that where the problem lies? Something in the production values?
Yeah, I'd say there has been a shift, especially from old films to the more modern day films, from a technical and a production point of view. You know, there's definitely directors and producers are definitely pushing for more authenticity in the actor's performance. So things like accents to be more real. The characters to be more real, and probably choosing performance-based authenticity over clarity of dialogue, you know, making sure that they believe the characters and are giving the actors performance as much brevity as possible over possibly something that is a little bit clearer.
So growling and muttering.
Yeah, growling, muttering, you know, gritty, real performances, how people would yell and scream and shout at each other in a real-world environment. You know, that stuff isn't always as clear as what the movies make it to be.
And refusal to use proper English, whether you're in Chicago or Glasgow or even some remote corners of Australia, a refusal to use proper English.
Yep, and the authenticity in the accent of a certain country or area, even if it's spoken in English, definitely sometimes tops the clarity.
Is one of the problems here that the cameras are outside in the real world? They're not operating, the cameras and the boom mics are not operating on a sound stage.
Yes, that is also something that adds a lot of location noise to the recordings. There's definitely more productions being shot on location than they are being shot in sound stages or film studios. And that brings with it the sound of the environment. And now as sound editors and sound mixers, we can obviously control some of that environment through things like ADR recording, which is getting the actors back into a soundproof room and re-recording their voices in sync with their mouths, or through certain amounts of noise reduction. But both of those things have their separate challenges, because sometimes the directors don't choose to go with the ADR because they're more attached to the natural performance from the location. And sometimes with the noise reduction, you know, if it's used incorrectly, it can actually work against the clarity, even though it gets rid of the background noise.
What does anchored to the dialogue standard mean?
Yeah, so that's a technical requirement for how measuring the loudness of a program or the loudness of a film or television show. And there's two formats for it, one of them being anchored to the dialogue and one of them being anchored to the whole sound mix. The anchored to the dialogue specification probably is the better of the two in terms of clarity, because it allows the dialogue to be the loudness reference. If you are anchored to the mix, it's the loudest points or the louder points in the mix that it'll be anchored towards. And so then it doesn't allow the dialogue to be as loud as when it's just anchored to the dialogue.
So I assume that these standards are used and, you know, we're not using sound stages, and all of this is about money.
There is definitely a wide divide between some productions that have more money or less money, and money obviously equals time. The more time we get as on set to record sound, the more time that we get in post-production to, you know, clean up and help fix the sound and design the sound and mix the sound, the better shows are going to sound clarity-wise. So that is often a challenge. Producers, they only have so much money in their budgets, and that's what everybody has to work towards. Some shows get more and will probably sound better and be clearer. Some shows get less and will suffer as a result.
So it can be cheaper to rent a street than to rent a soundstage and build a set.
You would have to ask the producers about that one. I'm not exactly sure, but definitely in constructing that street, I would hazard a guess that yes, it'd be quite expensive to build that in a studio. Rather than just having people walk out onto a ready-made street.
Andy, you won your Oscar for the soundtrack of Hacksaw Ridge. How much time did you spend in the production of that film working on the dialogue, making it as clear as could be?
Yeah, we had a great amount of time on Hacksaw Ridge. Mel Gibson was very much, you know, being an actor, he was very much on the path of getting his actors to come back in and re-record their dialogue. So we used a lot of ADR in that film. It helps with ADR when you've got a really amazing sound design and sound effects track behind you and amazing music as well, to be able to bed that ADR in really organically. But yeah, we used a heap. Andrew Garfield spent almost 3 days in a recording studio on Hacksaw Ridge, and I thank him every day for it.
But that cost obviously a lot of money.
Yeah, Hacksaw Ridge was a very good budget for an Australian production. It was all shot in Australia and post-produced in Australia, and the American producers knew that it required enough time to be able to bring Mel's vision to life. So, you know, they were very supportive of us having a good amount of time to make that film the way it was.
Now, I know you're giving comfort to a huge number of Australians when you emphasise that the problems are not in the down your ear, but to, at least to begin with, in the studio, in the making of the films, making of the television series. But
yeah,
there's also a problem, isn't there, with our television sets?
Yes, TVs have regressed. They've definitely gone backwards with the speakers over the years. You know, I've seen TVs that have the speakers pointing to the ground. They point out the back of the screen because they want to fill the whole screen. Yes, with the image. But you know, the flip side to that is that sound bars are sounding a lot better. If you are using the high quality earbuds and those types of earbuds and headphones and things, they do sound very good. But not everybody kind of buys into those things.
But you shouldn't have to. You shouldn't have to sit there with the... I mean, my grandfather, who got deaf in the First World War, had a wire running from the television set to a pair of two headphones, and that's how he always watched television from 1956 onwards. But we shouldn't have to sit like that.
No, I think TV manufacturers should definitely be stumping up a little bit of the blame here. They need to get good speakers in there and put them in the right place facing forward, please.
Do you, off the top of your head, know which of the series makers, which of the streaming services we can trust most with sound?
Well, interestingly, I do find Netflix to be one of the better ones. They do have the anchor to the dialogue spec, so they would probably be one of the better ones for clarity. Some of the others, which I probably won't name too much, do apply compression to the mixes.
Explain what that is.
Yeah, so compression is when you kind of hold back or squash the mix in a way that makes everything kind of sound one level. And what's happening there is that the dialogue is being squashed into the same frequencies as the music and sound effects. And so in scenes where the mixers and producers and directors may have pushed the dialogue a little bit louder, it's now being held back to a position where it's being unclear.
And, of course, we're also confronted these days with subtitles that are generated by a computer, and we watch these hilarious words coming out on the screen. I mean, it can be quite comic, but it's also pretty distracting. Is anybody making proper subtitles anymore?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't tend to watch too many subtitled shows in English. You know, and that's one of the benefits, I guess, of watching foreign language films is you can't understand the language. So if they do get a word wrong here or there, you would never know about it. But yes, there are definitely some funny moments when the translation doesn't quite come across in the English version.
It's hilarious. And also every and ah is there. And
right, yes.
Every hesitation and repetition. But now look, I want a picture of your household. The children have been sent to bed. Dinner is done, washing up is done, and you're sitting down to watch something on television. Now, what is the equipment around you?
Oh, wow. This is very embarrassing now, David, because my wife and I tend to watch off an iPad in our bedroom.
But Andy, please help me here. You're side by side in bed. You're sitting up, a couple of pillows behind you. Are you watching the same thing, or are you watching, you know, Gentlemen Prefer Blondes and your wife is watching David Attenborough?
Leah and I enjoy the same shows. We're both Academy members, which means we have access to all the Academy films.
Oh, of course.
I think 600 films a year. So we've got to get through a mountain of films to watch, and we tend to watch them together so that we can talk about them afterwards and have a bit of a creative discussion about all the great films we get to see. But no, we definitely watch the same things, David.
What a burden having to get through all of those films.
Oh, it's tough. Someone's got to do it.
Yeah, but Andy, I want you to just reassure the listeners of Late Night Live that there is no shame to watching the subtitles if you are over what sort of age, 35, 40, something like that?
35, 40, sure. I think, David, that people should do what obviously makes them the most comfortable. If the story is the focus for you, and it definitely should be, then subtitles are going to help you in that regard. But, you know, personally for myself, there's so many other visual things to be paying attention to in these modern cinema with the acting, the cinematography, the costume and production design and the editing that I just cannot bring myself to be looking at the bottom third of the screen when there's so much more to see.
Or you could just go to the cinema.
True. Absolutely true. Get out there, people.
I think on that clarion call, get out there, people. we shall say goodbye to you, Andy. Thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live and bringing this comfort to the listeners.
Thanks for having me, David.
I've been speaking to Andy Wright, Oscar-winning sound editor, about the reasons for and the ways to deal with subtitles on television. And that's the show. On our next, as war rages, Bruce Shapiro returns to talk Trump, father of discord, the great dealmaker who can't these days even get the warring parties to sit down together. Where's a railway carriage when you need one? Plus, we ask where IKEA, the Swedish furniture giant, gets all that cheap timber.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.